Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It is Friday, and so we will have a week in review. But before we do that, we have a real treat. All three of the most recent Nobel Prize winners in economics live here, and all three of them are with us this afternoon. Here in Studio 3 are MIT economists Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee. They co-founded MIT's Abdul Latif Jameel Poverty Action Lab, which in shorthand is called JPAL. And their latest book is Good Economics for Hard Times. It's only one of their partnerships because they also happen to be married. So Esther and Abhijit, welcome.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Duflo, by the way, Esther, you are the second woman and the youngest person ever to win this Nobel Prize. Is that correct?
That's right.
That's very exciting. Congratulations.
Thank you.
Now, with us on the phone, on the line, is Harvard economics professor Michael Kremer. Michael, welcome to you as well.
Thank you.
Now, you're also with us, and we want you to pull up a chair. We want you to come talk to us about this. Not very often in life you get a chance to ask questions of Nobel Prize winners. What would you like to know about the prize, about their research, about poverty, about what they're learning works? What do you think works, or what are you hoping to see in poverty policy here in the United States or in another country you're passionate about? All of that is most welcome in this conversation. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK, or you can tweet us at Radio Boston. So let me start. Esther and Abhijit, we spoke with you the day you found out, and it was exciting. It was fun to talk to you. I can't even imagine what's happened in the last couple of months. What has it been like?
Busy. I think it's the Nobel Prize is pretty unique in that it's the one time where the whole world suddenly gets interested in that particular subject and in the people who work in that subject. So we suddenly get tasked with representing economics to the broader world, and that's busy, exhilarating, a bit crazy, and a lot of fun.
What else, Abhijit?
Well, lots of selfies. Infinite number of selfies. I think I've had more pictures taken with me by strangers in the last 3 months than the rest of my life, and some, you know, and in a few other lives.
A few other lives too. How about you, Michael? What's it been like these last couple of months?
Well, when we went to Sweden, we heard that the poet Seamus Heaney described it as a benign avalanche. And I think that's the best way of putting it.
That sounds uncomfortable.
Well, it's a benign avalanche. So yeah. It's good.
I think the avalanche thing is just sticking in my head. All right, so let's start with the work that won the prize. Your, quote, experimental approach to alleviating global poverty and this pioneering of a use of what's called randomized controlled trials in this area, in these development policies. The Financial Times characterized the work as practical answers to small questions about poverty, but the award seems to recognize not just these practical answers to small questions, but the larger implications of that work. So Esther and Abhijit, I'm going to turn to the two of you. You focused on the world's 1 billion poorest people and have tried to figure out what would cause parents in rural India, for example, to increase vaccinations of their children, or how to increase the amount that teachers in rural communities attend work. Esther, break down what was new about this approach that led to the prize.
Yeah, I think a better way to characterize the questions we ask is not so much that they are small than they are well-defined. When we think about development economics, when we think about poverty, we start maybe with the broader question, which is why are countries poor and why are some people particularly poor in poor countries and why does it persist and what could you do about it? But at that level of generality, there might be very little concrete to say, and in particular, very little that you can really think about and that is also policy actionable. So the way we think about it is, okay, let's break down this big problem into somewhat more manageable problems. So you could think, for example, well, one thing that's very important is to have healthy people. So let's say once you've said, oh, health is really important for development, then you again haven't said anything that's very concrete. So you could go one more step of specificity and say, oh, preventive health is very important. And then we start talking. We could say, oh, what are the barriers that prevents people to access preventive health? And in particular, we could think about it in the context of immunization, for example, that you point out and say, what are the barriers? How come people don't access immunization services? The go-to policy answer is because it's too far from their house. So people invest.
You mean the assumption has been that people don't do it because
it's
just too far. Yeah,
that's been the assumption because it's too far. So most of the money in immunization in the world goes either towards inventing new vaccines, which is, of course, very important, or to make sure that the services are available. But then even once the services are available in a country like India, for example, it tends to be quite close to people, but still many people don't get an immunization.
The old, if you build it, will they come?
And in this particular instance, the many people don't come. So then you can start asking the question, what would make them come? And in the process, you get two things. One is you get policy recommendation, if you find something that makes them come. And I can turn to that in a minute. And also you get a better understanding of what are the barriers that really stand between people and their desire to do what's good for themselves and what their children.
So really, what drives particular behavior and why do people make the choices that they make?
Exactly.
So Abhijit, I'm going to move from small questions to well-defined, taking a cue from Esther. What is one of the significant answers to one of these well-defined questions that you found that was surprising or counterintuitive from a policy standpoint?
So one that I think had kind of lots of reverberations across the policy world was our evaluation of microcredit. Microcredit at some point was kind of the flavor of the decade, I would say.
And our listeners might also know that as micro-lending. Or...
Exactly, okay. Micro-lending, microfinance. The idea that you give small loans to almost anybody who wants them and that's going to transform their lives and they're going to become, richer and start little businesses that are going to flourish. I started as someone being optimistic about that. Turned out it was just not true. We did a bunch of randomized control trials eventually, and I think they very clearly show that this doesn't happen.
But billions of dollars globally banked on the fact that that was working.
That's the other side of that. So it's absolutely true that it doesn't. The average person who gets a microloan does not get any richer. That doesn't mean that it's not a good thing. It may well be that, when I get a loan to buy a house, it's not because it's going to make me richer. It's just make me happier.
You need a house.
I need a house. So when they buy a refrigerator with a loan, that's not making them richer, but they have a refrigerator. So I don't see this as being, I think this whole movement had to spin a narrative of winning every battle. And instead it won one important battle, which is getting slightly cheaper credit to poor people. And that was a valuable thing to do. And somehow that message is hard to get out because people either want something that's like win,
silver bullet,
or nothing. And somehow, but the message was actually that it didn't make people poorer. It didn't hurt them. It got them kind of consumer durables. It didn't make them richer.
So let's turn to Michael for a minute. And Michael, would you prefer that I call you Mike or Michael?
Either one's fine.
Okay. So I'm going to turn to you for a minute, and then the calls are just coming in, which is great. So I'll take some calls after that. Randomized control trials, that is a basic methodology, has been a long-term research methodology. You've been pioneering or did early on these types of approaches your whole career. One of the things that struck me was the Nobel Committee cited your work during educational interventions in Kenya in the mid-1990s. There has been some challenge to the idea of using both these smaller scale approaches and randomized control trials in a poverty environment. How do you think about that and that controversy?
So I think that, if I think about the case of, so I was a high school teacher in Kenya after I graduated from college and before I went to graduate school. And that was an experience that I felt like I learned a lot from. And one of the things that I saw was that many children were missing a lot of school, were sick, teachers were missing school. If you look at the learning levels, those learning levels were you were not what one would hope for. And since that time, the Kenyan government has adopted some policies which were initially tested in randomized trials and which were found to dramatically boost learning levels. And those policies have been adopted nationally. And we've seen the same sort of increases in learning levels that occurred in the randomized trials occurring nationally. So that's a huge benefit for all of Kenya to instead of assuming that we're going to use the same approaches that haven't been delivering results, to say, let's try innovating and see if we can come up with approaches that will work better. And in this case, you know, the Kenyan government did this, and it's been a big success.
Let's take some calls. 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Susan, you are on the line with our Nobel Prize in Economics winner. Susan's calling from Westwood. What's your question?
My question is, have you looked at and defined and been able to detail break out the economic impact of single parenthood?
In an analysis of poverty?
Yes.
Thanks, Susan. I'm going to turn it to the three of you and ask if any of you would like to answer that question for Susan.
I would say that it's probably exactly the kind of question randomized controlled trials are not ideally suited to answer.
So explain that.
Well, I mean, the idea of randomized controlled trial is that, you know, you compare somebody who is parented by a single parent and somebody who's parented by two parents, let's say. And you do that, you choose who gets to be in which category by a lottery. That's why the comparison is valid. Problem, and thankfully, we don't assign children, you know, single parents by lottery. And therefore, it's hard to do that comparison.
That'd be a little Hunger Games, wouldn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it would be extraordinarily unethical, I would say.
So. And within that, and I'll turn to Esther for that, you want to be able to isolate like that, I think if I understand this correctly, because you're getting at cause versus something that's correlated. Is that right?
Exactly.
And can you explain that a little further?
So the idea of a randomized controlled trial is to do the same thing that you do when you try to evaluate the impact of a new drug or a new treatment protocol, which is you compare. You're really thinking about an intervention. So you're thinking about, so if we go back to the example of single parenthood, why you would not randomize single parenthood? You could randomize access to a program that would help single mother take care of their children in the evening, for example, or guarantee them daycare access so that they could go to work. So you could randomize support. So there is really two things in it. One is when we're thinking about randomized controlled trials, typically you're thinking about what would be the impact of an intervention. Single parenthood, nobody would ever think of that as an intervention.
And an intervention for the layperson means something that you do, a service you provide,
incentive
you offer, etc.
Exactly. Something where a policymaker or an NGO or a firm intervenes in the world. And then secondly, of course, the value of the randomized controlled trial approach is that because you are randomly assigning your intervention, so take the example of support for single mother in this case, you are comparing like with like, because the people who got the intervention in this case are exactly similar to the people who didn't, because the only reason why one group got it and the other didn't is because of the randomization.
All right, let's take another call, 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Pastor Steve is on the line from Duxbury and has a question for our group today. Pastor, go ahead.
Well, thank you. I'm wondering about the minimum guaranteed annual income. I know that Sacramento has experimented with targeted grants to people living in poverty out in California. What about this minimum guaranteed annual income as a way of addressing poverty here in the United States?
That's a great question. And just to provide a little bit more rounding to that, we've seen quite a bit of discussion about that over the last few months in the Democratic presidential primary, because candidate Andrew Yang, who until recently was in that mix, was advancing the idea of what's also called a universal basic income, or in his case, a freedom dividend. Let's just hear him explain that a little bit, and then we'll go for an answer.
So it's enough to be a game changer. It would make us stronger, healthier, less stressed out, mentally healthier, would reduce domestic violence, reduce hospital visits, would dramatically increase the graduation rate and many positive social indicators, but it's not meant to be a full work replacement, and it's certainly not meant to solve every problem.
So, Abhijit, I'm going to turn to you, and then I'm going to ask a follow-up question to Michael. Go ahead.
So, in fact, I think there are a number of indicators suggesting that, you know, there's something to what Mr. Yang is suggesting. There is, for example, we've done a set of trials where instead of giving people an income, we give them an income-earning opportunity and we follow them over time. We've done this in a bunch of developing countries, not in the U.S. But you do see that over many years, 10 years later, these people are, you know, more productive, happier, healthier, etc. On the other hand, this particular intervention that of giving people a regular assured cash, that's something that actually there isn't really and something that doesn't substitute for anything else. You just get it. It's not that you get it and I take it away if your income goes up. That actually has never been properly tested. We're doing actually the first, I think, large-scale trial on that in Kenya. The first set of results should be available in the next 3 to 4 months.
People will be watching for that, I think.
So I think that's unfortunately the state of the knowledge.
So Michael, if you'll indulge me for a second, let's pretend that Andrew Yang were still in the race and somehow he gets elected president of the United States and wants to do a trial in the United States on universal basic income. Based on the research method for which you've won this award, how would you advise him to go about that? How would one try that in a way that would help us understand its efficacy in the United States?
So my understanding, this isn't an area that I specialize in, but my understanding is that a small-scale trial of this is going on, I believe financed by philanthropists, in the United States, as the caller indicated, in California, where some philanthropists offered to provide the funds for this. And then I assume that there was some sort of lottery that determined who won this opportunity. And then they compared the lottery winners and the lottery losers. You know, they did surveys afterwards to try to understand things like employment rates, for example. You know, one of the potential concerns might be, well, if people are getting regular money, maybe they work less. Or now, my understanding of the results from a program in Kenya that I'm aware of, although I wasn't involved in the study, is that they didn't find evidence of that. But you know, one could test that. You know, the results could potentially be different in the U.S. One could test that. And you know, Andrew Yang went through a list in that clip you played, went through a list of benefits, and one could also test for those benefits. So you know, then it would. That would be the basic approach.
Okay. Michael Creamer, Abhijit Banerjee, Esther Duflo, please stay with us. We're going to take a short break, and when we come back, we'll talk more. Callers, listeners, stay with us, too. After a short break, we'll have a little more conversation. So stay with us. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering, and we are still chatting with all three of the most recent Nobel Prize winners in economics. In studio here is MIT economists Esther Duflo and Abhijit Banerjee. They co-founded MIT's Abdul Latif Jameel Poverty Action Lab, or the shorthand on that is JPAL. And their latest book is Good Economics for Hard Times. Welcome back. Thanks for staying with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And on the line is Harvard economics professor Michael Creamer. Michael, thanks for staying with us, too.
Glad to be here.
Okay, I'm going to go straight to a couple of calls. We've got Maureen on the line from Shrewsbury. Maureen, what's your question?
My question is, has JPAL ever done any studies of the effect of poverty on families whose children have been removed by DCF and are attempting to get them back and by trying to meet the requirements of, you know, the agency, but they're trying to work two jobs while they're being told they have to get to this appointment and that appointment, et cetera?
So looking at that role of government intervention on the outcomes for the kids, Maureen?
Yes, exactly.
Thanks. I'm going to give them a chance to answer that, but I want to grab a couple of calls here. Let's also hear from Tim in Worcester. Tim, go ahead.
Hi, good afternoon. I don't have a question per se. What I want to do is thank you and applaud you for taking your vast skills and abilities and apply them to the subject that you have. We spent $8 billion to build a machine that can take a picture of the backside of Pluto, and I do understand there is technology that can be cross-applied to the benefit of society, but there are people everywhere just trying to subsist every day. And for people with your vast knowledge to study this subject and find what works and what doesn't work. Yeah, maybe they can't get a house, but yes, they'll get a refrigerator. A refrigerator is a gain. This is where we need to be focusing, the people on our planet and the people most at risk. So thank you all. God bless you all. Keep you safe and continue your good works.
Thanks for that call, Tim, and for the passion in your appreciation of their work as well. So, Esther, let me turn to you. But first, you're welcome to respond to Tim and that lovely call from him, and then also talk about what you do or don't know about the role that a government or a government intervention plays in, DCF or in other countries, whatever the foster format is there.
So, first of all, thank you very much for this call. I obviously agree with you. We have chosen to devote our lives to these questions because we think that they are the most important questions that as humanity we need to grapple with. They also happen to be fun and interesting and give you an occasion to meet wonderful people along the way. But we are, I think, the three of us really passionate about solving these issues because as societies, who are we if we cannot help our try to understand the issues faced by the poorest people amongst us, and I think society is the world society. On the specific question that was asked, the honest answer is I don't know, but I will provide you a way to find out, which is that, one of the things we are working mostly on in developing countries, but the JPL works all over the world. And we're also trying to make an effort to accumulate the knowledge that other people have also produced using randomized controlled trials. So by going to our website, www.povertyactionlab.org, you can have access to all of the studies that exist. And if you put something like a children removal in it, you might be able to get an answer to your question. Another place to look for an answer is in the registries for experiments. So there is a big registry where everybody who is currently working on a topic describes their experiments. And that is searchable. So if you go there, you can find out not only what has been done, but what people are working on today. And the last, so that would give you a sense of all the knowledge that I don't have that actually might be there. And the last thing I would say is that it is an extremely important topic, this idea of the ability of people to stay with their children. There used to be a time where many very well-meaning social protection system assumed that the best way to help children was to remove them from their poor parents. And it's been done systematically with Aboriginal children, for example, in Canada, mm-hmm. with poor children in Switzerland. It's still being done regularly with very poor families in France, for example. And it's one way in which you remove not only an attachment between the child and the parent, but the dignity of the parent. And one of the things that we highlight in our most recent book is the way in which our entire social protection system has not taken into account, have not put at the center the dignity of the people who need protection. And the way in which not putting dignity at the center of social protection has perverted not only the social protection system, but our entire way of dealing and interacting with each other in society.
So I want to pick up on the word choice Esther made there, which was dignity. And I'm going to combine it with a word I heard you use, Michael, before the break, which was lottery. And it raises for me this question of when people are poor and vulnerable and we are trying to figure out what works, randomized controlled trial means that by, draw of a straw or flip of a coin, to be oversimple about it, people may not get something that would make a fundamental difference to their expression of their human dignity or their ability to, live to their full human potential. How does one struggle with the ethical dimension of that while doing research that you also need in order to figure out what works and expand it, Michael?
So the I think there. So any time that there's a study like this going on, they are reviewed by what's called institutional review boards or human subjects committees, which are charged with looking into those questions. And as Abhijit said, there's many cases in which it would not be ethical to do a randomized trial. But at the same time, if, for example, and to take the example that I gave, which if there's a particular approach to pedagogy and somebody has an idea for trying another approach, and that in many cases, it's not that there'll be a view that informed view that the existing approach is better than this new one, or that the new one is better than the alternative. So saying that trying to experiment with this and learn what will be more effective is something that that not only hypothetically could have a big impact, but in fact has had a big impact. And so in those cases, that would be something that a review board is likely to approve. The decisions ultimately, I think, have to be made by the governments involved, and by the researchers also have an obligation to be ethical. And the review boards are designed to provide some oversight for that.
Thank you for that, Michael. We've got really, it goes fast. We've only got about 3 minutes left. And Abhijit, I want to turn to you. One of the things that, if I understand it correctly, and you are Nobel Prize winners, so it is possible that I don't, but one of the things, if I understand it correctly, is that you've done research on essentially cash transfers and the role that giving money to people can play. We talked about that a little bit with the caller who called about guaranteed basic income. I spent a long time before I came here in anti-poverty work, and in the United States, especially in the philanthropic community in the United States, for a very long time, there was tremendous resistance to the idea that money should go to anybody who's experiencing poverty, despite the fact that part of what poverty means is lack of money. Do you think your work has begun to shift attitudes in the United States about that, and should it?
Well, in the United States is... the work is mostly in developing countries, at least my own work. So I don't know how much it's entered the mainstream of the U.S. I mean, we try to make an effort in our book to drill on.
Should it? Should it penetrate?
But it should, in the sense that I think there is very little evidence, even in the U.S., to the extent that there has been attempts to study this, there's very little evidence that the kind of the bugbears that people always bring up, these people are going to become lazy, they're going to start drinking, they're going to do all kinds of awful stuff as soon as you give them free money. Just no evidence for it. And this goes back to the late 60s. The New Jersey negative income tax experiment was one of the first randomized controlled trials in kind of social science anywhere in the world. And what they did there was very much exactly this, which is offer people some free money. And it's not that the free money made them lazy. There was no evidence or very little evidence that they stopped working. So I don't think there is any smoking gun which says that, these awful stuff will happen if you give people cash. More recently, we've done things like, giving people cash rather than food or something. And again, when you give them cash, they buy the same amount of food. They don't eat any less. So it's not that the money vanishes into whatever, gambling or drinking or all the other things that are kind of the natural reference points in these conversations.
And Esther, thank you for that answer. And Esther, in the last 30 seconds, let me just give you kind of the last word. What else would you want our listeners to understand about your work?
That might take more than 30 seconds, but...
But I don't have more than 30 seconds.
I think the most important thing is to say is that what we are trying to do is to understand how people live their lives and to not let ourselves be overcome by our intuition. Too many
our
times
intuition.
Intuitions. Too many times in the policy world, you run with an intuition saying, oh, the poor are going to become lazy if I give them money is one intuition. Or the poor will just all become Bill Gates if I give them credit is another intuition. What we are finding in our work is intuitions are fine, but never trust them. Just always test them because so much is riding on getting the right answer to design programs that are effective and to understand the real constraint that people live and the real motivation for their behaviors that we cannot just leave it to guesswork.
All right. And that is MIT economist Esther Duflo. Thank you for being with us today. MIT economist Abhijit Banerjee, thank you.
Thank you.
Harvard economist and Professor Michael Kremer, thank you.
Thanks.
All three are winners of the Nobel Prize in Economics. Hey, stay tuned. Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Dearing. This is Radio Boston.